Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Arlene Cohen.
You're listening to that midweek version of the Fiber Talk podcast that we do twice a week for those people who care about needle and thread. Yes.
We're not stabbing this week?
No, we're just going to care. I think we're just going to care this week.
Caring is a good thing.
Yeah. So up front here, coming up Sunday, is Tanya Berlin. A Berlin embroidery. There's a multifaceted, multi-talented lady there. You want to check her out. So that's coming up Sunday. And then you had your book, your big annual book sale last week, right? Last weekend?
Yeah. So this is a huge book sale that I've been involved with on the volunteering side. I can't, you know, at least 10 years, but it's probably closer to 15. It is billed as the largest used book sale on the East Coast. I don't know who actually keeps track of those things, if there actually is a competition.
there's somebody who needs a life right there.
But it makes for good, you know, copy somewhere. Right. But it's huge. And certainly, book dealers and people who own used bookstores and of that nature, they know, you know, where are the sales you go to stock up.
Back up. So this is so big that used book dealers actually come to.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Whoa.
Yes.
Whoa.
Gary, you need to be on the used book circuit a little bit more. Dealers go to a lot of sales like this. They may or may not hit like the small library sales, but they certainly hit larger sales. And like I'm thinking of a big sale I went to in Connecticut this past summer that was a huge library sale. But big sales like the one I'm involved in is definitely a place where a lot of book dealers and booksellers go to stock up, because sales like this sell books, I'm going to say it, relatively cheaply. The vast majority of the books at the sale that I am at sell for $2, and then the smaller paperbacks for $1. There is a lot of exceptions to that, and there is a collector's corner with higher priced, and a lot of children's books are 50 cents, but that's the range we're talking. So if you think about book dealers, they go and they stock up, and then they can sell it, you know, for a few dollars more than that, especially if you're talking about, you know, well, any, I was going to say, if you talk about online sales or even a brick and mortar store. So many big sales like the one I'm involved in, the quote first day, I wouldn't even say opening day, the first day, charge an admission fee. And book dealers happily pay that admission fee so that they get first dibs. And there's only been once or twice that I've worked that opening day. I personally much enjoy the setup days. But the times that I have worked the sale days and have chosen to work the opening day, it's a sight to behold. they purchase their tickets. The people who are choosing to pay the admission fee, they purchase their tickets ahead of time. A lottery system gives them numbers. They line up by number.
Holy smokes.
There is somebody with a megaphone that counts down and it says the sale is officially open, and they go running. And that part of it is a little bit for show. I mean, there isn't, you know, we're not talking about some kind of, you know, golden egg that everyone is running to at the same time. That part is a little bit more about the excitement of the hunt is starting, you know.
Okay.
But in those first few hours, there is just like pull. And, you know, they gather, as you know, and really the people who are working in that beginning morning, there's no cash registers ringing up for a few hours, because there's like hundreds of books that they are going to be purchasing, and they're not ready to check out for quite some time. Or many of them will actually do it in stages. You know, they will cover one area and then check out, cover another area. And then there's some people from the general public that just like to come on the first day, and they're willing to pay that money just to come on the first day. But in general, And I know of other big book sales that will do the same thing and will charge an admission fee for the first day. And anyone can come, but that admission fee is really the extra incentive for book dealers to say, hey, we get first dibs. And then the rest of the days, it's open to the public, no admission charge. You go, you buy, you enjoy yourself. So this book sale that I'm involved in gets rents space at a school that is on spring break. And so if you can possibly picture it, and it's unfortunately hard to get pictures just because lighting just doesn't work very well, or at least on my little camera, my phone doesn't work very well. An entire gymnasium, an entire lunchroom, and then a third, we'll call it multi-purpose room, is completely filled with tables of books. And like the post I put on Instagram, just trying to, so how did I get involved? Well, of course I love books, but I particularly love books on the topics of needlework of all kinds. And I don't know if I quite did this the first year, but certainly by the second or third year I was involved, I became in charge of the hobbies and crafts area. And what that means is that so books are collected all throughout the year. There's a donated space where people in this area can drop off books. And it is to me, unbelievable that the amount of books that are sold each year are collected every year. Like it's not like they carry over books from one year to the next. Those are how many books that have been donated in one year's time. So people donate throughout the year. There are there's this space. It's like a barn. It's referred to as a barn. And then as the space gets filled up, storage units get rented, and more storage units get rented, and more storage units get rented. And they're sorted in the barn. The books are sorted by categories, and so they come into the school during the setup days in boxes according to categories. So history. Crafts, cooking, you know, and those boxes, and they hire moving people to do it. The boxes come in, they get delivered to the tables where you're working. And then I'm in charge of unpacking all the boxes. And then what I do for my category is actually organize them, because within one box of hobbies, there could be needlepoint books, chess books, drawing books. So the hobbies category, people have said, is quite a catch-all category. And I take the time to organize it. This year I had four tables. So picture, I don't know, what's a standard folding table? 8 feet long?
And yeah.
Whatever. Actually, many years I only have three, so I was very happy they gave me four this year. But they have their mathematical calculations of how many tables they need for any given category. Based on how many boxes that the category has collected over the course of the year. And so I unpack, I sort, you know, I was putting all like the art and drawing on one end, and I was putting the chess and the Sudoku and the crossword puzzles in another area. And I was putting the needlepoint quilting. Oh my gosh, there's so many quilting books this year. And then of course there's the general craftiness. That's what I end up putting, things like basket weaving and
macrame.
Yes, there was a little collection of macrame this year, and Christmas decorative, and you know, all kinds of things. And then there's a whole system that when you're unpacking, you keep the books flat in piles, but then when you're done, you put them spine up. So the whole process takes a number of hours, but I was pleased with my work when I got everything all set up. And I'm no dummy. When I unpack those boxes, I take first dibs on any books that I find.
I didn't realize how big this was. Now I understand how you keep coming up with these gems.
Yeah.
Wow.
It really is huge. And, you know, there's some books I see every year. I'm like, oh, yep, there's another one. And sometimes, some years ago. So it's evolved over time in terms of categories and pricing and so on. There was a period of time where a lot more categories were priced. Like, for example, the art books are priced. You know, many of those art books are large, like coffee table books. Those don't sell for the default price of $2. There was a period of time where a lot more categories were priced. And when I was pricing hobbies, now granted, most of them I was pricing for $2 or $3, and it just took that much longer for me to write, you know, but sometimes I can still find my own handwriting in some books. So, you know, some books get donated right back to the sale, which is always funny when I can find that kind of thing. It is huge. And it's a way that I've collected a lot of my needlework books over the years. A few gems, a few wow, I've never seen that before kinds of things. Now it's always fun to like be on the lookout for friends or for people who have this interest or that interest. And when I'm done with hobbies, I every year will also then go help with children's is a huge area. They need multiple helpers there. And that, of course, has evolved into finding lots of gifts for the little ones in my life. So, it's always fun to go visit nieces and nephews and be the book auntie who always brings them books. So, it is a huge undertaking. There are, I was going to say dozens, but it's probably well over 100 people that are involved in making this happen. And all the money that's raised goes to scholarship funds. So it is it's a fundraiser for scholarships for college, which is always a good thing. Although a lot has also been said over the years as every volunteer run thing struggles to find the volunteers, you know, and the group has gone through, you know, how long are we going to be able to sustain this kind of thing? The realization that it also serves a community need, you know, it does. It becomes a place where people know in this area where they can bring their books. It's a place where it has been known that people, like prominent people, have like left their entire book collections. And for the week's time, I mean, it's quite a, I want to say a social gathering, and I say that in a very positive way. There's a lot of good to see you again, and how's your year been? And it serves a social purpose which is very nice. You know, there's a lot of retirees that work at this. There's no doubt about that. I got involved a lot of the times because it occurs during my spring break and I'm available. There aren't too many working people actually, but they do keep the site open in the evening. So I haven't been there too much in the evenings to know, but there probably definitely are more working people that come in the evenings to help out. So, I have definitely found lots of good treasures over the years. There's no doubt about that.
Yep. Well, that's pretty neat. I did not realize how big that is. That's pretty cool. Yeah. And I knew you when you took them out of the boxes. I'm sure that this one gets set aside and that one gets set aside. Yep.
Yes.
Why not?
Yes. And there's always this little letdown when I've opened the last box and it's like, okay, all I have to do now is the rest of the work.
Yeah. The discovery part's over. Yeah,
exactly. The discovery part is over. Uh-huh. And you know, the hope of, you know, and every year there's fun things that this year I found fun things, and I will be sharing some of them in a future video, I'm sure.
Yep. Speaking of your videos, your most recent video, you made a statement or had a little segment that really caught my ear. And I haven't finished, actually, as I think about it, I haven't finished your whole thing. But anyway, most of it I have. Mm-hmm. But you talked about, with FlossTube, so many people doing so many projects, buying so many charts, and so on and so forth. And I thought it was interesting. You talked about getting caught up in that and how you're not that kind of a stitcher. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was an interesting perspective because I see that a lot. And, you know, you watch FlossTube videos and you just talk to people in general, whether it's FlossTube or not. And you see people acquire a lot of stuff And, you know, there's always that running joke of having more things than I can do in my life. I mean, I think we all have that problem. But I thought it was interesting in getting it, just the perspective of getting caught up in that instead of being true to what you are as a stitcher. And because you're a one project kind of person, and and sticking to that and not getting caught up in the in the mad rush, I guess. I don't know. Because it's real easy to do.
Sure. And I think there's some people who love getting caught up in that mad rush. Like that's what appeals to them. And that's what gives them their energy and their excitement for the craft, the hobby, their passion. That their passion is diminished when they have to, quote, have to stick with the same project, or and I've seen multiple places and all the social media posts and people talking in videos about how there really are two hobbies at play. One is stitching and one is collecting.
Yes.
And I get that. I guess you could say the collecting hobby is not one that I have. I mean, I take that back. I mean, I collect, I don't collect the patterns in the way I think a lot of people share on their FlossTube videos. I also think, and I've certainly had some conversations with people at my LNS who don't make FlossTube videos. So, just trying to say that everyone does things differently. You know, everyone does what works for them. And I think that one of the things that I'm making a generalization here, and I want to be very cautious when I make a generalization, but it seems to me that a lot of the people who love to make FlossTube videos love it because they have lots of things to share. They do have a lot of different projects that they're working on. They do have a lot of different patterns that they've acquired, or really excited about this new pattern that this new design or this new designer that they've discovered. I think that might be a characteristic of a lot of floss tubers. Not everybody. I'm not in any way stating that. And so I think when I was saying that little bit on my video, I was just trying to say, I do feel a little different because it's not something that is true for me, but I do believe there's plenty of other stitchers out there that are like me. They just might not be the ones making FlossTube videos.
Yeah. Well, it's, and you're exactly right. There really are, you could easily make two hobbies out of this. The people who buy, acquire, and kit and stitch some, and then the people who just put their nose to the grindstone and finish projects. And there are people who have a lot of projects and stitch and don't really worry about finishing because they're more interested in the experience of doing whatever stitching is involved. And if they don't finish it, they're not real concerned about that because it's that experience during the project that matters to them. I'm in many ways one of those people. I like to finish projects, but I don't, you know, I'm not on a mission. I enjoy the process of stitching it. And then once it's done, I couldn't care less. There are the different hobbies, and there are people who, That's the fun part, is acquiring these charts and acquiring threads. You know, there's people who just love to buy thread. Yeah. And but I just thought it was interesting because the floss tube in particular kind of fosters that, I have to buy that. I have to buy that. Oh, I really like that one. I need to go get that one. And if you're a collector, yeah, that's, you're going to go do that. But if you're, you know, staying true to yourself as a stitcher, if you have a project and you're working on finishing it, it's kind of easy to get caught up in that kind of that race, if you will, and instead of sticking to what you do. And nothing wrong with it. I mean, it's, you know, whatever you want to do, it's whatever makes it fun. But
And I don't know how much. I mean, I guess I would say it's more like FlossTube exposes you to so much more than perhaps you have the ability to experience on your own, whether it's just you in your local needlework store or whether it's you in your own searching online and whatever sources you use online. But then when you have this other venue, which is now people showing you what they're doing, or especially when, I mean, I think everyone will always say when you are seeing a pattern being brought to life and how different that is than the picture, you know, that's on the cover of the pattern, that just, I mean, I so get how that can make a person say, wow, I would love to have that, you know?
Right, right.
And I think, I mean, you've alluded to this so many times in so many ways, how the phenomenon of floss tube has really done wonders for the cross stitch community, because it really has given so much more exposure to stitching, to designers, to patterns, to so much that maybe just wasn't there 10, 15 years ago. And that's just wonderful, you know, right. Just because so much more to share in a new venue.
In a new venue and on a global basis. So yeah. you get perspectives, you get charts and approaches to charts that you would not get if you were just limited to your local community.
Absolutely.
And I think that, to me, that really broadens and solidifies the base of stitchers in terms of the interest levels and what you can do and where you can expand to. And you're exactly right. When you see a design evolve and unfold on a floss tube that you maybe not would not even have considered or looked at and thought, meh, you know, whatever. And then you see it getting stitched and it's, wait a minute. Yeah. Like you said, wait a minute. I think I have to have that thing. Because there is that reality, the stitching reality is so much different than the picture on the cover. And then when people get creative and start changing colors and doing other things, with them embellishing or whatever it might be, you get ideas and you go from there. It was just interesting. It just gets to that aspect or that facet of the hobby that interests me and always will, is the human nature, the human approach, and how everybody does it different and everybody sees it differently. And this is a hobby where you can do that. I think more than most hobbies, because there's so many ways to manipulate needle and thread that you can find your own niche. You can explore doing just little projects just to see what it's like without a lot of investment. And in a lot of hobbies, that's just not an option.
Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, well, it's just interesting. I just love that, that whole aspect. So, yeah, I was most curious. Now you talked about you did a long trip to the West Coast, saw lots of things, but, since we had the ladies from the San Francisco School on, yes. Fiber Talk here, I was interested in your reaction to the place. And of course, my first question is, did you ever leave the library room?
Well, it's all basically one large space. I mean, there's a few other it's all basically one large space. There's a few other like nooks or rooms. And I realized after the fact that I didn't even spend that much time. There was a display of, you know, sort of quote their current exhibit. And I'll be honest, I don't think I really spent much time looking at it, which I felt so bad about, because, you know, there was so much that you could spend time looking at there. For me, I was very, so just to back up, I had definitely put it on my list when we were going to San Francisco that I wanted to go there. I contacted them ahead of time just to confirm that you could go and look at their books. You know, there wasn't a class that was going on that I wanted to join or, you know, take or anything like that. I wanted to see their books. I wanted to see what they were. The response was, yes, of course, you're welcome to do that. And so, as I had described, and I think they shared in their conversation with you, it's in an office building. You wouldn't know, you know, that you are walking into anything as amazing as it is when you, you know, go in the building and go up an elevator and go into a door. But behind that door was just the most amazing things. So all, you know, whole walls filled with shelves of books categorized. And so it would be wonderful if I lived in the area and I knew that I wanted to do research on, you know, learn more about a particular something, a particular topic. You know, I would go and love to spend time with the books they have on that particular topic. As it was, I was just doing sort of a quick scroll through, scan through a whole bunch of things. I was writing down some names of books and taking some pictures of books just to potentially follow through, looking for inspiration for my future designs. I mean, that's what a lot of, I've realized a lot of my, forays out into the world, you know, whether going to a museum or other places like that, I'm always looking for inspiration. And so especially some of the older books was just fascinating to look at. But this was not a specific mission of I want to go learn more about X, Y, or Z. But then, so did I spend time outside the library? Well, there was this other smaller room that was more or less their lunchroom. I mean, they were just trying to keep one space where food would be. And it turns out, well, there were more books in there because they just didn't have enough shelf space in the main room. So, and that just happened to be where a lot of their design, I forget what they call that category, but it was more or less like a lot of the design books were. So I was in there for a little while. They had a cabinet of what I guess you would call their oldest or most, maybe most fragile, but most special. I don't know what you'd say.
Oh, kind of the treasures, huh?
The treasures. And at the same time, she was like, I'll open the cabinet for you. And we were looking through the cabinet things. And it wasn't, I appreciate this as someone who has gone into libraries, into special collections, into archives. There was no putting on the white gloves. There was no, you know, of course we were careful and, you know, handling everything with great care, but it was just wonderful to just see all the treasures that they had. She was telling us about, I was looking at a copy of, so William Morris, who a lot of people are familiar with for his wallpaper designs and his time period of the like late Victorian times, his influence in that whole time period. His daughter, Mae Morris, really deserves a lot more credit than, you know, most people don't know about her. And people should know more about her. She was the head of the embroidery department of William Morris for quite a number of years. She did a lot of designs and a lot of work on her own. So there's a whole story of Mae Morris. She published a book, and I want to say it's something like The Art of Embroidery, but that may not be the title. And you can find you could find scans of it online because it's 100 years old. You can find, but I think you could also, I think there's also like reproduction versions of it out there. Anyway, I happened to be holding a copy of that book, and I'd seen it before because I had seen it before in other archives or libraries, but it was Lucy, one of the founders, who commented to me when I was talking to her about this Mae Morris book. She said that that copy that I was holding was an unusual one because it was one of the first printings, and I think it had a white cover, and the cover that people usually see is the one with the red cover or vice versa. I don't remember. But the copy that they have there in the San Francisco school is a copy that the William Morris Museum in England doesn't even have.
Oh.
That they, the two founders, whichever one of them, you know, originally got that copy of the book, that however they got it, I think the V&A in England has a copy, but it's a pretty special book. And they, you know, this little place in San Francisco has a special copy of a special book. And I just think that those little stories are pretty special when you learn things like that. So, you know, there, one of the friends I was with is a local. She lives in the area and she works in San Francisco, just a few blocks away. And she had been vaguely aware of it, but she was like, gosh, I'm so glad I now know of this place. And I said, oh my God, if I like worked close by, because they have some of their events are like lunchtime events,
right,
you know, or like right after work events. I said, I'd be coming here all the time. and I appreciate, you know, you were just mentioning about going to learn new things. I appreciate the idea of learning something new or trying out something new by taking a class, like a class. We're not talking about committing to a 6 month, you know, learn how to do goal work. We're talking a 1-2 hour session of a small little project. And hey, if you like it, there's another class to take. But if you don't, that's okay. You know, you spend 2 hours and a few bucks to learn it. And that's what this place could offer to those that are there. I mean, they're also doing quite a lot online and offering ways to have people participate. I mentioned in my video, I'm trying to remember if you, Carrie, I've also mentioned this, the world's longest band sampler that they are.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they have in their various ways that they've encouraged people to participate in their exhibits and in their, they don't call them competitions because they're not competitions. They just encourage people to send in things to participate. What's going on right now, or one of the things that's going on right now, is they're trying to collect stitched bands or part, you know, stitch pieces that will then get stitched all together to create a giant band sampler. And I just think that is a marvelous idea.
I think they do a lot of neat things that allow people not in the San Francisco area to participate. And it's really creative the way they handle it.
Yes. Yeah. And while we were there, there was a gold work class going on. Mm. And when I looked at the calendar, you know, just to see what was going on that day, and if I'm remembering correctly, it was like, you know, week three of a 6 week class or something of that nature. So it was an ongoing class. And it was, you know, it's wonderful to see that kind of work up close and to know that there was a handful of people that were doing classes like that. It was just, it was marvelous. And they also have some opportunities for people who do want to, you know, plan a trip. And this is what I want to do. I want to go spend that week. You know, they're having a week long, blah 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 of whatever. And you can, you know, participate by that kind of experience as well. So you have a lot of things going on there. But again, I could see myself wanting to just spend plenty of hours reading through books and, you know, getting all kinds of ideas. And
yeah,
I mean, I want to own a lot of the books that they have.
Well, and you can see that if you work nearby, it would be, Arlene, want to do lunch today? No, I'm going over to the school. I'm doing a class. And I mean, you would be there a lot because of a resource like that. And
absolutely.
Yeah. Go after work, before work, whatever it takes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that's good. I was just curious to hear firsthand from someone who'd been there. So, mm-hmm. And then, we were talking before we started recording, cause I had put on our list of things. I'm curious if, just one of those what if things. If money were no object and you could go to the Royal School, for instance, for a month, you know, what classes would you take? You know, you just carte blanche, you just go do whatever you want mm-hmm. for a month.
Well, so it's an interesting question because I will often look at, I get like the Royal School newsletter, however those come out. I get EGA ANG sends out their, you know, when you get the yearly seminar things. What's the big thing that happens in Australia like every 2 years?
The beating around the bush or something.
Whenever I get these things. And I try to imagine, even for the briefest few seconds, you know, what if money and time were no object? You know, what would I want to go off and learn and do? And, you know, it's a hard call, because there are times where I guess my focus is certainly I would want to do something that I couldn't learn for myself using a book or a really good pattern. Like that, that's one piece for me that a lot of what I've done, I think I'm correct. I've done a lot of things that I would say I'm self-taught. And that's not to say I've done everything correctly. I'm not going to claim that. But there's a side of me that is self-taught in a lot of ways. And so I would want to do things that are hard or challenging to be done in a solo format. One of those things that I had for a number of years really wanted to do and kind of couldn't get over the hump of was gold work. And I have a number of gold work books. I love the look of it. I love, you know, everything about it. But, you know, I even have one of Tanya Berlin's, as you mentioned her at the beginning. I have a kit of hers with very good written out instructions. I just haven't done it yet. Actually, I bought the kit and then something happened in between, but I hadn't started it yet. Although I think her instructions are so well done. I should have been able to just pick it up. But then I had an opportunity to take a class, a 2-day class, local EGA group. And it wasn't, we're not going to claim, I don't know. It was gold work with silk thread. I forget exactly what the title of it, with, I'm blanking on the teacher's name. But it was where maybe the name will come to me, but the point where I'm going with it was really helpful to be sitting in a room with a number of other people who were all working on the same project and to be working through it together. There was a teacher there. There was also very good written instructions. And, there was almost a side of me that was like, what helped was the atmosphere, you know, that we were all sitting together and doing it. And the teacher had some very good suggestions and so on. What I learned from it was that gold work was not something that I thought I was going to love doing on a regular basis. And I would not have known that had I not had taken this 2-day class. And the reason I say that is because the materials involved, and certainly, you know, you got plenty of other people. I'm thinking about Mary Corbett here, who can speak much more eloquently than I can about this. But, you know, I have my stitchy spot. I have my position when I'm stitching on a regular evening. And when it comes to goal work, you have lots of little pieces and lots of little things, and you need to access them in a different way. And I see that you need like a table and you need to be set up in a different way. And gold work, at least my little experience there, did not lend itself to an evening of stitching, shall we say. And so I learned from that class experience that I love the look of gold work, but I didn't know how much I could do gold work because it wasn't going to be the same kind of stitching experience that I love about stitching in general. That said, if I were to go to the Royal School of Needlework and I was going to be taking classes, if I'm going to take classes, I'd want to take a class, more classes in gold work, because I'm going to be sitting in a spot where you know what I mean?
Yeah,
you know, where
yeah.
So that's one thing. The other thing that I just want to be saying this correctly is that I want to make sure that I always stay true to myself as a stitcher. And there are times where I want to be precise and careful and do what, you know, to my level of caring, of making it look right. But I also have been in situations, and I'm thinking also in my bobbin lace world, where I'm okay with fudging some things, okay? And I hate the times where I have been in situations where I have felt, is such and such really needed? Is such and such really necessary? And I wonder how much, I don't know. There was a, so I don't know if I've told you that I visited the Royal School of Needlework many years ago. I don't know if this has ever come up in nope. our conversations.
I don't think so.
Many years ago, I was in London, or I was in England. I was at a teacher education thing at Cambridge. I then spent almost a week in London. I timed, like I chose to, the timing of my return plane ticket was so that I could go to the Royal School of Needlework. At that time, they had a once a month, I think they called it something like open studio. And it was like open to the public. You could come and take tours. I think they were certainly doing classes and so on at that time. But really, if you wanted to see the place, you either were taking a class or you could only go there once a month. And so I literally timed my return so that I could go there. Like the last thing I did in England was going out to the Royal School. So it was wonderful. I was so glad that I could see it. And I unfortunately don't have a whole lot of very clear memories of, I mean, I remember certain pieces of it, but, and I think the little tour was only about an hour or so, but the few things that stuck with me was that they were very, as you can imagine, very, very precise. Like, this is the way you have to do things. And I remember just thinking, but what if somebody doesn't want to do it that way? You know what I mean?
Right.
And then the other thing that very much stuck with me was they were talking about their like their certificate programs, their diploma program. I don't have the right like diploma program. People who go there for like 2 or 3 years and study and
right.
come away with a degree that they then use as a career of some kind. And somebody on the tour had asked about numbers, you know, how many people come, how many people are part of your program and so on. And the person who was guiding us around did share that, you know, it is not unusual for, I don't remember the numbers, but let's just say they had 10 people coming in that year and one of them had dropped out. And they said, and one person dropping out or 10% drop, whatever the numbers were, was not unusual because people come and discover that the thing that they love to do for an hour or two every night is not – it kills their love when they're doing it for 8 hours a day, 5 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
And that just stuck with me so much because I remember thinking, you know what? I you know, because I think up to that point of the tour, I was almost trying to imagine – How could I become a student here? You know, how could I sit and just spend my days stitching? And then when it was expressed in that way, I thought, you're right. I don't know if I would love it in the same way. And I don't know if I would love it if the level of expectation was just, let's just say, a different level than what I had for myself.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, see, I've wondered about that. If you were in a situation like that where you were stitching all day long, just what impact that would have on your view of the hobby.
Exactly.
Yeah because, I mean, there are certainly plenty of people in the hobby who clearly stitch vast majorities of the days.
Mm-hmm.
Because they just crank out so much stuff, they have to.
Mm-hmm.
But for those of us who get a couple hours a day tops, you know, maybe a little more on the weekends. Yeah, I wonder how that would be. Would it energize you even more or would it just completely turn the valve off and you go, gee, get me out of here?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But see, that's the part that for me to go, I'm with you on gold work. I'd want to learn gold work from people at the Royal School. But then my other one would be needlepoint. I'd want to take as much needlepoint as I've done. I'd want to take a needlepoint class at the Royal School just to learn and see and hear that precision. This is the way it's done. You know, you Americans may think this is how it's done, but this is how it's done. And I would like to have that as part of my foundation, I guess. I think that, you know, whether I would stick to it or not is immaterial. It's having that in your head that I think is valuable as a foundation. So I'd want to do that. I'd want, even if all we did was basket weave all day long, I'd want to have somebody saying, well, you didn't do that part right there quite right. Here's how to get that right. Just to have that. I think that would be, and I, you know, I have a general, I think you and I are a lot alike in that I'm mostly self-taught because I've done that with everything in that if you give me a good set of instructions and a chance to study them, I'll generally figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
And I may not do it precisely the way some master teacher would do it, but I will generally figure it out and find some level of success with it. And while classes, I've taken a few, maybe three or four. You certainly pick things up.
Sure.
But I've always been one, and everybody learns different. I've been one who learns by reading. And you and I, you're a teacher. I'm a former teacher. We know that everybody learns differently. And some people have to be shown. Some people have to see it. Some people have to hear it. It just depends.
Yep.
And that's, you know, that's the part of being a teacher is you got to reach all those people. But yeah, I've always been one. Just give me the words on paper. I'll figure it out. If there's a couple pictures, yeah, that'll help. But generally I'll get it out of the words and go do it. And, so it's to me to take a class there would be more for the experience than the actual learning of a technique, except for gold work, which I've never done. And I would really, that's what I would like to see somebody have somebody teach me. I think that would be one of those where it would really pay off.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know, but it'd be fun to go. I mean, you've been there. So I think it would be fun to go and just be in those hallowed halls for a while.
Yes. I mean, I think, when you get the chance to do experiences like that, absolutely, sure. I will say that there's a time it's like wants to go back to San Francisco and take a class with them there. I think just watching Lucy in her class, you know, with the students that she had, that which again was a goal work class that was going on, you know, that's always just an inspiring thing to just be in an environment that is enthusiastic and excited about what's going on, you know,
with
the spring. So, yeah, absolutely.
Well, yeah, and that's just it. We don't have to go to England. We have that in San Francisco.
Or in the places that...
there's a couple places in the East there that you could get the same kind of thing, I think, or similar.
Yeah. When the Royal School, like, sends tutors to the U.S., like, I don't want to say this incorrectly, but there have been times where they're, like, during the summers, there are some options of taking classes that are sort of, quote, officially or unofficially, I don't know what the words are, or you could get that level. I know because a friend of mine did it. She went, I want to say it was like North Carolina or something like that, that she went and took a class with a Royal School tutor. And I know she very much enjoyed it. So
yeah, they have, it's like a regular satellite program.
Satellite program. Yes.
Yeah. Every year in the U.S. you can take that, mm-hmm. go to the Royal School on the road kind of thing.
Yeah.
I'm sure it'd be worth it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Time.
Well, time and money. That's life. But, you know. Well, another one that I sort of a little bit on the same vein is Japanese embroidery.
There's one that'll test everything. Yeah.
Yeah. So I learned about Japanese embroidery, like the whole like concept of it. There's this thing. What is it? Okay. Basically about a year or two after my sister moved away from the Atlanta area. And if you know anything about Japanese embroidery in the U.S., the Center for Japanese Embroidery in the U.S. is in Atlanta. And I remember at the time thinking, if I had known about this, I could have gone down there, you know, stayed with my sister and taken classes. So at the time, this is a number of years ago, I had just begun exploring. Again, it was too late for me to take advantage of go visit my sister, stay with her and take classes there. But it was enough for me to start exploring a little bit more. And, you know, and there's a situation of they have a very precise level one, level two, you know, levels that you go through.
Yes.
And a very precise methodology of what you do and how you do it. The results are stunning. The results are beautiful. There's a book. I have a book. Of course, I have a book.
Of course you do.
Of course I have the book. The book is not, I would not say it's quite enough to kind of do it on your own. I don't think they were claiming that when they created the book. But I wish there was sort of like a, and I know this would not be in their spirit. I get that. But I sort of wish there was a Japanese embroidery light. You know, here's the spirit of Japanese embroidery.
I don't think they do that, Arlene.
But I want some understanding of it. But I will say this. There is a woman, and we need to look up her name, and then you could have her as a guest on the show, who is doing classes. Because in addition to Japanese embroidery, there's like Japanese beading or Japanese embroidery bead. Like there's a beading component to Japanese embroidery. And there's a woman who does classes through ANG and EGA that's based on beading, the methodology of Japanese beading, but it's not following the precise, the precision that is, I'll go ahead and say, required of the Japanese Embroidery Center. But I like what she does.
Yeah.
And that's what I mean is that I'm looking for something of the spirit of it without, you know, because when I looked into it, it was sort of like, I would love to come. This is what I'm talking about. I would love to come take a 2-hour, see if you're interested class.
Mm-hmm.
And then I could decide whether or not I want to commit to this. Because, you know, let's face it, I'll go back to the story of how I started Bobbin Lace. I started Bobbin Lace because I saw someone demonstrating. And she allowed me to hang out with her for 2 hours. And during that 2 hours, I knew I was going to be interested in it. And then even the amount of money that it took to commit to doing it wasn't a huge significant amount. If you are interested in Japanese embroidery, at least at the time that I was looking into it, there's a commitment involved.
Yes.
I wish there was a way to kind of see if you're interested. You know, like, again, like what San Francisco is doing. Here's a I think they call them taster class. Here's a taster of gold work. Here's a taster of white work. Here's a taster on crewel. Come take a 2-3 hour class. See if you like it. And hey, if you like it, maybe you want to sign up for the 6-week class. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Free technique, including Japanese embroidery, had something like that. I don't care if I just make one tiny little flower. You know, show me the basic ideas. Help me understand the spirit. Help me understand the essence of what this is about so that I can decide if I want to get into it or not.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, we had a lady do a presentation at our Needlework Guild meeting a couple of years ago. Japanese embroidery, and mm-hmm. it's so much more than just needle and thread. It's
yeah.
it's a cultural thing. It's a very rigid progression through the phases or stages or whatever it is.
That's it, not and, level phases.
Yes. And of course, the work is just absolutely mind-blowing. It's just so precise and so beautiful, and just everything about it is just, you just stand there with your jaw on the floor because the thought of accomplishing that, but then you accomplish that through years and years of you know, basically being told, no, go back and rework that because it isn't exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that's a different world. And I tell you, anybody who's made their way through that, you really got to respect them because that, like you said, it's a major commitment to get involved in that if you want to do anything with it that amounts to much. And yeah, I agree, a little taster, but even that, I Japanese embroidery, even if you say, all right, I'll give me the 6-week course, it's a whole lot more than that. So,
mm-hmm.
That stuff is so beautiful. But you know, that's a cultural thing too. You know, that's lifelong learning approach to things that. we don't necessarily have. So.
Yeah.
Yep. All right. That's going to have to be it, Arlene.
Okay. Well,
just going to have to be. Thanks for listening. Tanya Berlin on Sunday, and next Wednesday, I think, is Vanna or Debbie Rowley. Well, it'll have to be one of the two because Arlene is this week, right?
Yes, that's the way it works.
That's pretty much how it works. So we'll figure that out. All right. Thanks for listening.
Take care.